From Studio Studios in sunny Southern California, it's the Get Off My Lawn podcast for the week of January 29th, 2023. On tonight's program, New York Times bestselling author David Mack talks Trek, Tim and Kevin talk movies, and Craig, who is on vacation, doesn't talk at all. I'm your guest announcer, Tim, and now here's your genial host, Kevin.
All right, thank you, guest announcer Tim, and welcome everybody to the Get Off My Lawn podcast. You didn't think you'd see another episode this year, did you? Ha! Fooled you. But you don't hear Craig today, because Craig is, as our announcer Tim has stated, on vacation this week. So you get to chat, or I get to chat, and you get to listen to me chat with Tim. Tim, how you doing?
Oh, so far so good. Here in a beautiful, not-so-sunny Colorado. It's fairly bitterly cold. It's gray. It's gloomy. It looks like we might get some snow. You know, if you had seasonal affective disorder, this would be a great place to be right now.
You have a cat on or near your person, so I don't think you get to complain, right? Isn't that the rule?
Guideline than a rule. I like to take any opportunity I can to complain, but I do have a cat with me. And if I complain too much, she'll scratch me. So Everything is great. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And not to make this into the cat podcast, but our cats are maturing. And by maturing, I mean they're becoming more like cats and not pleasant to be around. Is that...
Okay. But they're not maturing in the way that they're, you know, making good decisions.
No. They decided this morning that they needed to attack each other. And my wife will contend that the cat who chose me is the way it's worded, Jax, is the bad guy in this, is the villain in this. And Lego, who is the cat who chose her, is the victim in this. I believe that it happens in equal measure from both of them, but she disagrees, and who am I to argue with my wife? But
Sure. Regardless,
some howling and scratching and gnashing of teeth occurred. So yeah, that was a fun way to start the morning.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't drink coffee, so that is like caffeine. We're awake now. We're running out of bed into the living room to count the number of limbs on cats. That's how we start the day.
But this is more of a coffee sense in if you woke up and had a pot of coffee thrown into your face.
Yeah, pretty much. So we're going to talk about film a little bit later after the interview here, but I guess you and I haven't chatted on the podcast about sort of who you are and what you do when you're not watching movies. So anything you care to share with us? Open up, Tim. It's your time to
well,
open
sure
up.
Well, as far as I am and what I do, I'm the movie critic for aboutboulder.com. Try to find all kinds of interesting things to see on a weekly basis. And when I am not doing that, I am involved in screenwriting. I am currently working on the second draft of a action horror feature, and trying to break into Hollywood and trying to make some art that isn't terrible or stupid.
Good luck with that. Let me know how that goes.
Yeah. So far it's been terrific.
If you're not pitching a reality series featuring somebody who has appeared naked on the internet, it's just not going to happen. So sorry to disappoint you. That's the rules. I don't make the rules, but
and you're not the first person to tell me that.
So we will be chatting about a particular horror movie that you forced me to watch in a few minutes.
Yeah.
But before that, we are going to chat with actually an author of Star Trek books, TV, and all kinds of other things. Do you read any Star Trek novels in your spare time there, Tim?
I haven't in many years, but I certainly would if they were recommended to me.
Well, David Mack is a pretty good author of them, and he's written, I think, like 2-3 dozen of them, as well as a couple episodes of, I think it was Deep Space Nine, and we'll talk about all of that. But the main reason I wanted to get him on the show is that for about the last 20 years, there had been no television Star Trek. So there had been no Star Trek canon that had to be dealt with in the novels, if that makes sense.
Sure.
And so then along came Picard and Discovery and all of these other shows, and all of the authors of the novels that had done their own sort of sense of continuity for the last 20 years had to figure out how to fix that. And so,
And I'm sure that that was easier than fun.
this is not a spoiler because it has been much talked about in Trekkie media, but they decided the best way to do it was to kill off everybody in the Star Trek universe all at once.
Okay,
Now,
then. All right.
imagine you are a Star Trek fan. How does that sound to you? How do you think it went over among the Trekkies? How do you think that flew?
I can imagine a good half dozen better ideas. I can imagine that the Trekkies, upon hearing this, were less than pleased, perturbed.
So David Mack had to do that. He was tasked. He and a couple of other authors did a trilogy of books that wrapped up sort of the novel continuity to make way for the new revised canon continuity of the new TV series that had been coming out, and had to explain away why there was a difference in continuity, and then again do justice to the characters as they each met, in many cases, very, very gruesome deaths. So, including children, by the way, those were also.
Great.
So it's a happy little series of books. As So
Okay.
I went into the concept really disliking it because I am a Star Trek fan, and I did own not a lot of Star Trek novels, but several of them. I've gotten to appreciate some of the series. And so I went into it really wanting to despise David Mack and the people who had done this, but I'd really liked books they'd written in the past. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to read it. And so that's what you're going to hear today is sort of my reaction to the books and to David reacting to me reacting to the books. But really, it's a good conversation about sort of how Star Trek has changed and evolved. He has been a consultant on a couple of the new series, the animated series. That have gone on. So Star Trek Lower Decks, if you haven't seen it, I do highly recommend it. If you are in any way a fan of Star Trek, they do pretty good justice to it. And then the newest of the animated series, which was described as sort of a kid's gateway drug for Star Trek,
Sure.
Star Trek Prodigy. It was produced, co-produced by Nickelodeon, but it was sort of a way for younger people to get into Star Trek, also has had mixed reviews. So we'll talk about all of those things and some books with David Mack. We're going to do that in just a few seconds. I am joined today by New York Times best-selling author David Mack. He's here to talk about his most recent book, and I might try to nudge him into talking about some other things too. Mr. Mack, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You have a new book, one of many that you have written under the Star Trek banner. Tell us about this one first before we get into some of the other stuff that's going on in your life.
My most recently published Star Trek novel is called Harm's Way. It's part of the original series line of Star Trek books. So it's based on the classic 1960s version of the Star Trek mythos and those characters. It also crosses over with Star Trek Vanguard, which is a literary original Star Trek series that I co-created back in 2005 with editor Marco Palmieri, and on which I alternated the writing of novels with the writing duo of Dayton Ward and Kevin Delmore. They would do the even-numbered books, and I wrote the odd-numbered books. And it ran for a total of seven novels plus one anthology that had four sort of lengthy, substantial novellas of about 30,000 words each. So that was a pretty good chunk. And now this sort of adds to it. There was also an ebook, sort of a post-series grace note, if you will, written by Dayton Ward called In Tempest's Wake. And that occurs as sort of an afterword, an epilogue to the Vanguard saga. But this new novel, Harm's Way, takes place right in the middle of the Vanguard saga. If you were looking for chronology, it would fall around the middle of Book Five, Precipice. But that being said, you don't need to have actually read anything about Vanguard to appreciate this novel. And a number of reviewers have actually already mentioned that. I wrote it so that someone who is just a fan of Star Trek in general, the classic series, can jump in and anything you would need to know about the Vanguard series, about Operation Vanguard, or any of the elements connected to that, It's explained in the text. You won't be lost. You'll be able to just come in and enjoy the adventure by, you know, just jumping in with both feet.
Sure. And I'm a huge fan of the Vanguard series, the space station with a mysterious thing going on. So it's a good series that's worked its way through. I don't know that I've read all of the novels, but I know I've read, I think, the first three or four. So I will be happy to jump into Harm's Way when that one.
Well, then you're in the perfect position to jump into Harm's Way. You're like right on the money. As for what the book itself is about, it's a sort of a classic Star Trek formula called, you know, problem on ship, problem on planet. The problem on the ship is that a prominent Federation scientist has gone missing on a planet in the Klingon neutral zone. Kirk has to go in there and try to find this guy because he's got prominent political connections. And he's got to do it in a way that will not ignite the Cold War with the Klingon Empire into a shooting war. Meanwhile, the problem on the planet is that he has sent Spock with a landing party, which is a mixed landing party of personnel from Kirk's ship and another Starfleet ship, which is the product of a bit of a bureaucratic mix-up involving Vanguard. And they have to go down there to this planet and get into all sorts of shenanigans with the natives, and they're up against the Klingon strike team that's also been sent down there. So while that's going on, we've also got in orbit a Klingon warship. We have a D4 commanded by Captain Kang, who viewers might remember from the episode Day of the Dove, which was an original series episode, or from the Deep Space Nine episode Blood Oath, where we saw a much older version of Kang. So this is sort of one of those episodes that plays into the mythology that Kirk and Kang knew each other and had a rivalry before the events of the episode Day of the Dove. And Kang has pretty much the same problem Kirk does. He's itching for a fight, but he's been given the same orders. Don't start a war unless you can find a plausible way to blame it on the other guy.
That seems like a tale as old as time, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk to you for a couple of minutes about, and I'm holding it up, not that anybody else can see it but you, but I not too recently polished off Oblivion's Gate, the last of the Coda trilogy, and that one is probably, I don't know that it's the most talked about Star Trek novel, but it's one of them in the last couple of years here, and it was the one that sort of tied up, it completely tied up all of the novels as sort of the canon of its time to make way for the new TV series that have since, that you've had a part of as well, whether it was Prodigy and Picard and some of the other ones. So you were able to write what I can only describe as sort of a Star Trek's version of the Alamo, where you put all of the characters in a battle, and you know, with no hope of escape, and not to spoil it, but it's been out for a year, and it's been talked about, like I said, in multiple different forms of media. I haven't heard you speak to it, and if you have, forgive me, but I wanted you to sort of talk about it because I did like your explanation and justification for everything that you'd written in sort of the epilogue and the sort of the closing notes about it. But tell me about this book and the daunting task of this trilogy that sort of wrapped up what we who are Star Trek novel readers knew as the canon of Star Trek.
Well, first of all, I have actually been on numerous podcasts talking about the book. I try to avoid getting involved in direct conversations on like fan forums. I don't want to sort of get into sort of arguments or debates about my story choices, mostly because it comes off as defensive. There's really no way to try to explain one's narrative rationale without somebody thinking you sound defensive doing it. So I just try to avoid those online conversations for that reason. In terms of what CODA was about, we being myself and fellow authors, Dayton Ward, who is also part of the licensing team at CBS Television now, and James Swallow, fellow New York Times bestselling author like me and Dayton, and he's based in Britain. He writes a lot of thrillers and audio dramas and works for video games, etc. We knew, maybe going back to 2018, 2019, when Picard started getting talked about, that we were going to be in trouble. That once the TV producers returned to the late 24th century era of Star Trek storytelling, and just started crafting new narrative and new backstory, that they were inevitably going to overwrite and supersede a lot of what we had been doing in the post-finale books. Because what we had been doing in the novels, the Star Trek novels, since around the year 2000, 2001, with the, you know, end of most of the TV series happening in the early 2000s, Nemesis sort of putting a capstone on TNG in 2003, DS9 already being over, Voyager coming to a close, we were given a lot of leeway to sort of carry that narrative of Star Trek, of these characters, past the end of their show's finales to sort of say, and what happens now? And so we were allowed to, you know, tell stories that altered the status quo of their lives. Some characters lived, some died and lived again. Some who died were brought back to life. And so this narrative grew and grew and had all sorts of multi-series crossovers, one of the most notable of which was my Star Trek Destiny trilogy, which was published in 2008. And that's, you know, the big end-all, be-all clash of Federation versus Borg. Two civilizations enter, one leaves. We get to see both the origin of the Borg and the end of the Borg. And, of course, you know, Picard brought back the Borg, so that kind of just blows Destiny completely out of the water. But what are you going to do?
Yeah.
So we had about 20 years of this kind of free license to tell all kinds of meaningful stories that had consequences, which was something we were not really allowed to do very much in the era before this. Like back in the 90s, which was in a lot of ways the heyday of Star Trek publishing, with, you know, sometimes two paperback original novels per month, plus ebooks at some point. That was, you know, a flood of content. But one of the restrictions on it was you had to put the toys back in the box where you found them.
Yeah, you had to reset all the characters and all the settings. And yeah.
Right. If you had any incremental change, if any character was going to undergo a change, it was either going to be your guest star or it had to be something like of a minor nature for a major character that could plausibly have shifted in their perspective without it altering their character, you know, as seen on screen.
Right.
Or it, you know, had to be sort of a think piece or whatever. But in any event, we were allowed to move beyond that paradigm for about 20 years. But the moment we saw that the TV producers were stepping back into that arena and that time frame that we had been working in, crafting our stories after the movie Nemesis and, you know, going forward almost 14, 15 years, well, we knew we were done. And so we were saying, all right, so what are we going to do? And the real, you know, the sort of sad answer is really there were only going to be two options. It was going to be one thing or the other, and there was no other way to go. Either the publisher was simply going to cease producing books in that continuity mm-hmm. and just never talk about them again. They were just going to end. Not even end, they were just going to stop. That would be one way to go. The other way to go would be that there would be commissioned some sort of a work, either one book or multiple books, that would either bring to a close as many as possible of those ongoing literary narratives and try to find some in-universe story explanation for this concluding note. You know, and we would either end in a way that realigned or reset the literary universe to fall into sync with the TV shows, or it would set the stage for the literary universe to be supplanted by the TV shows. And the latter inevitably seemed to be the way to go just because they blew so much of our continuity to pieces
quickly. Yes, they did.
And so that was what we were faced with. And we knew this was coming down the pike. And, you know, Dayton and I had a meeting about it. James and I had a meeting about it. James was in town. I think this was just before the pandemic. This might have been 2019. He was in town for like a thriller conference over July 4th weekend. So I brought him along to a friend's barbecue cookout, and we hung out and we had some beers and we talked about the idea. And originally James wanted nothing to do with CODA. He thought it was a misbegotten idea, and I know some fans probably agree with him to this day. But eventually I won him over, and part of how I won him over was explaining, look, these are the only two options. If the folks at Simon and Schuster go with option two, and it's not us doing it, who do you really trust with this?
Yeah.
And he was like, damn it, you're right. So he signed on. It was one of those, you know, you son of a bitch, I'm in moments. So I got him aboard. Then I was talking with Dayton, and I sort of explained to Dayton what, you know, the narrative idea James and I had cooked up. And he looked at me and he's like, I had almost exactly the same idea. He says, except there's a few minor differences that are necessitated by what's happening. I go, what's happening? He goes, dude, it is so much worse than you could possibly think. Because he was in the loop. He was seeing story drafts, sure, and scripts and everything. He had a lot more hard information at that point than I did. But the three of us teamed up and we made our pitch to the editors and we explained what we wanted to do and why we wanted to do it. And they, of course, were apprehensive at first. This was, you know, a big move to essentially, you know, take down our own work. Basically, you know, write, you know, the swan song to 20 years of labor, not just by ourselves, but by, you know, the 20 years of labor by many, like, yeah, dozens of our fellow Star Trek authors. Yeah. And so there was a lot on the line here, emotionally, professionally. But eventually, you know, they sort of liked where we were going, sort of metatextual idea of it, where the story itself of CODA is a commentary on the circumstances in our real world that led to the gestation and creation of CODA. And it's, you know, it operates on a lot of levels. It's a metatextual comment on its own creation. And then beyond that, it can be read as an allegory either for criticism of late-stage capitalism, or it can be read as a, you know, as a think piece about cancer. You can read it as being a book about cancer, the illness, or you can just read it as a meditation on the inevitability of, you know, of death. You know, it's a meditation on mortality, and how does this affect one's ability to, you know, function in the daily world. Like, you know, how do you go on? How do you function when you know you're fighting a battle you can't win? At what point, you know, how do you stave off nihilism? And a lot of fans, I think, just, you know, they were not ready for this book because they didn't want the storytelling universe to end. And there was no way we could write something that was going to please them, because anything that brought it to an end, they were going to find a reason to not like it. But, you know, essentially, and a lot of them misread it as being this nihilistic work where we're just burning everything down and we don't care. And I'm like, well, no, you have to read a little more closely than that. The whole thing is an argument against nihilism. Mm-hmm. It's arguing that, you know, even when you know you can't win, maybe there's a way to not lose. That sometimes it is worth it to do the right thing and the noble thing to save others, even when those others will never know what you did to save them. They will never know that you existed, but they will get to continue to exist because you have made this sacrifice. Does that make your sacrifice worth less, or does it make it worth more? Does it make it more noble knowing that there is no other reward in it other than knowing you have done something good, that you have gone down to the last minute, the last second, the last breath, your very last moment fighting against the dying of the light? You go down to the last second fighting for what you believe in. That's honor. That's courage. That's nobility. And where I think a lot of people saw hopelessness and nihilism, I saw the fire of purpose. I saw people who were saying, this is what we have lived for. This is how we have lived and what we've always said we believe in. And we're going to die as we have lived. We are going to die fighting for what we say we support. Because what you fight against matters as much as what you fight for.
Sure. One of the things I took away from it is, you know, again, obviously CBS Paramount, they own the rights. They can decide what is and isn't canon. They can decide, you know, where these characters ultimately go. And like you said, for a couple of decades, that was entirely up to you guys, the novelists, because there wasn't any really established, you know, furtherance of the story in media, whether it's films or television. Once they started doing it, inevitably, you know, those of us that were fans of all of it, there, you know, we compare, we contrast. We're like, well, that's, you know, that... even taking away Star Trek, look at Star Wars. You know, how many novels there were for Star Wars. And then when we finally got new Star Wars stories, it was nothing close to the novels. So, of course, we as fans want to be critical of it. But ultimately, I had to respect a couple of things with this trilogy. And the main one is that your versions of the characters acted as I believe, as you know, maybe again it's just from all of the following of the other novels, but they acted the way I felt they were supposed to. And I can't claim the same with the stuff that is now current, you know, canon in the world of television. For better or for worse, that I believe it's a compliment to you guys and the stuff that you did with those novels.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
Yeah, and I was, you know, I was a detractor having not read them, if that makes sense.
Well, that's fair.
I went into
it. I mean, it's a pretty, I have to admit, it was a hard sell.
Yeah. And you know, I'm looking at the blurbs for them when they were initially come out, you know, when they were initially released. It's, you know, this is the end. And they're like, really? Ah, you know, and it, like I said, it took me back. You know, I just wasn't sure how to react to it because, like I said, I've been a part of those, or those characters have been a part of you know, my established beliefs of what Trek was for a long time now. So I believe you did them justice ultimately in the end. And as you said, I didn't get that you were advancing the cause of nihilism. I got that you were advancing the cause of how these characters would react in a true no-win scenario, which is at the core of many different stories of Star Trek. So again, I you know, give you credit for that.
Oh, thank you.
Taking you back a little bit, just as we have limited time here, taking you back sure. A lot of bit, how did you first get hooked up with the world of Star Trek?
Boy, you ask a question that's going to have a very long answer. I'll try to read it, digest it for you. The short answer is I broke in on the television side. I spent many years writing rejected spec scripts, using the open door policy, first at TNG and then later at DS9. I eventually managed to get around the whole spec submission process by teaming up with a guy named John Ordover, who at that time was one of the editors acquiring Star Trek novels for Simon & Schuster. He had the access needed to call up the producers and schedule a TV pitch, but he had no training in how to write a TV script. Whereas I had a degree in screenwriting from New York University, but no access. Mm-hmm. So you put us together, you had chocolate and peanut butter. We made sure, first of all, we did a couple of sample scripts under strict conditions to make sure that we were capable of, you know, executing a professional script under the time constraints that we would be given in the real world. Satisfied that we were ready, we scheduled some pitch meetings in early 1995. And our first pitch meeting was at Voyager, and that led to an immediate sale of a story to Jerry Taylor, a story called Sick Bay that ended up never being produced. And then a couple weeks later, we had another phone call with Ira Stephen Baer and his people at DS9, and we pitched them some stories. They bought one right off the bat called Starship Down, which aired in season 4. And they were interested in another idea, but they weren't sure where it fit in their plans, but they said, let's put this one on hold and we'll revisit it. That episode, that idea went through many permutations, and 3 seasons later, in, you know, late season 7, became the episode It's Only a Paper Moon.
Okay.
So I broke in writing for TV, and then afterwards we were never quite that lucky pitching again. We tried many more times, but never really made any more TV sales. But I started working freelance for John in the Star Trek books office, doing things like reading slush manuscripts, writing reference materials for other authors, writing filler material where it was needed. And eventually, you know, the editors came to know me. They came to trust me. They started throwing me bigger side gigs. And then eventually in 2000, I was hired to write my first book for Star Trek, and that was the Starfleet Survival Guide. Which was based on the, you know, inspired by the worst case scenario survival handbook, but for, you know, things that could only happen to you in the Star Trek universe. So I was hired to write that. That project worked out pretty well. So from there, I was invited to pitch the ebooks. That went well, had some success over there, got some good reviews over there based on the strength of that. When somebody else dropped out of a big 9-book miniseries project, that consisted of 4 duologies, you know, with a capper book. The penultimate duology was supposed to have another author. He dropped out at the last second. And I was offered the gig. And so I stepped in, and basically that happened in 2003 for books that came out in 2004. And that was when I made the jump up to paperbacks. And one of those books, Time to Heal, hit the USA Today list. And that's how I've been writing, you know, Star Trek novels ever since. And during that same time period, John and I, we wrote like a Star Trek 4-issue comic book miniseries for Wildstorm. I did work on lots of reference materials for Star Trek, like the Omnipedia, Captain's Chair, Starship Creator. I was working a lot with the team at Simon & Schuster Interactive, developing, you know, a lot of these electronic projects, these CD-ROM projects. Yeah. But once I got into the novels, I sort of turned my focus 100% in that direction.
Now, that said, you are once again back as a consultant in the world of television, working with them on
well,
the
not anymore.
Oh, not anymore.
No, I'm done. Actually, that gig ended back in my work for it ended last year. I got my last paycheck for it in March of 2022. I've just been waiting to sort of see the finished product because animation takes a long time to produce, in some cases, even longer than live action. But I worked only on the first season of Lower Decks, which was 10 episodes, and only on the first season of Prodigy, which was 20 episodes. After that, because of various reasons, budget cuts, which inevitably happen on every show, the low-hanging fruit is you always cut your consultants and you cut your junior writers and, you know, people like that. So I and, you know, I think several members of the Prodigy room, as they say in Hollywood, we did not have our options picked up for season two.
Yeah.
No one is ever fired in Hollywood. No. You didn't have your option picked up.
Yeah. You just don't get the phone call. My favorite story of that was when Jerry Seinfeld was working on Benson, that sitcom, and he found out that he was fired when he showed up and they didn't have a script for him for the table read.
Yeah. That's usually a warning sign. You know, the other warning sign would be if you find out from someone who's been at the table read and you said, what table read?
Yeah, that's another way.
Yeah. So that was sort of how I found out I had not had my option picked up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was talking with Dayton Ward and he mentioned something about, you know, this, that, the other thing that he had seen in, you know, the first season two script for Prodigy. I said, there's already scripts for season two of Prodigy. The room is back in session. He goes, the room's back in session for, and he paused and he went, you didn't know, did you? I said, no, I didn't know. He goes, I'm sorry, dude.
Yeah, that's harsh. I guess there's no easy way, but yeah, that's harsh.
It's never fun.
I will say that, you know, Prodigy was pitched, and, you know, ostensibly it is a children's, you know, animated series, but
it's for young adults too.
Yeah, it became sophisticated. There's a sophistication to it and a true sort of higher minded story to it beyond just, you know, how it was originally sort of sold when I saw it, you know, promoted. So
it's always had that quality to it since the very beginning. The Hagemans had a very neat idea for it from the very start. They wanted it to be more than just a kid's show, more than just a vehicle for selling toys. You know, they sincerely wanted it to be good Star Trek, good science fiction. It was intended to be, and I think succeeds at being, an on-ramp for a new generation of young Star Trek fans. For them to get a hold of it, it interrogates the very concepts of what Star Trek is about, what Starfleet is, what the Federation is, what are its ideals, what is its philosophy, what does that mean in practice? Show us, you know, what that looks like. And so it's a great way for new young viewers to be introduced to these ideas through characters who they can relate to. And at the same time, it's so well put together that their parents, who are likely also Trek fans watching with them, can enjoy it on a different level, but just as much, because it's great Star Trek in and of itself.
Yeah. Yeah. And then same, I went in, same as I did with your Coda trilogy, as I went in with Lower Decks with, well, low expectations. I was not expecting to like it as much as I did as that one came out. I thought, it was going to just be nothing but self-referential, which it is, but in a really well-done way. You know, they really poke fun at everything that is Trek, but with a love of Trek behind it, so.
They're very sharp over there.
Yeah.
Very sharp.
Yeah. Oh, I also wanted to point out my favorite bit in the Coda trilogy is you getting Mira Picard to tell Wesley to shut up. That, to me... There was just that.
And then he finds it oddly satisfying.
I remember that. Yeah. I think all of us sort of appreciated that, who read that.
Shut up, Wesley.
You do a couple of other things that are not Trek related. Did you want to talk about that in our remaining time? Just mention briefly some of the other stuff that you work on.
Let's see. In terms of what's already out there, if folks are interested in tracking down some of my original creations, I wrote a trilogy of books for Tor. The trilogy is called the Dark Arts Trilogy. The first book is called The Midnight Front. The second book is The Iron Codex. Book three is The Shadow Commission. Big idea behind those is secret history, which is kind of like alt history, but different. The idea is that there were secret things happening behind the scenes of real history. In this case, black magicians, sorcerers, who are using demon-powered ceremonial magic based on sort of the Renaissance-era ceremonial magic of the 15th century. And essentially, it turns out this is real. And there are certain limitations, and essentially the first book is set during World War II, so it's a war epic that covers 6 years of the war in Europe. And then the second book, The Iron Codex, it was written as a John le Carré Cold War spy thriller. Nice. That, you know, it's got all your usual things. You know, you're hopping from country to country, you've got exotic locales, you've got spies, you've got assassins, and of course, it's all got something to do with the fusion bombs being tested in the Marshall Islands. And then the third book, The Shadow Commission, is, I've described it to people as 3 days of the Condor with ceremonial black magic, or 3 days of the Condor with demons. It takes place during the week immediately following the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963. And it tracks basically the rise of a conspiracy that is turned against our main characters, who are, you know, magicians training other magicians. And then suddenly there's just this global conspiracy that turns against them to wipe them out, and they're being hunted. So that's the premise behind Dark Arts, available from Tor. As for what I have coming up, no new original novels yet, but hopefully across 2023 and early 2024, I have five different short stories, original short stories coming out in various formats, various anthologies or whatever. I'm not really at liberty to talk about many of them.
Okay.
Because in some cases the anthologies aren't announced, but there's some fun stuff. And it comes, you know, it's you know, a mix of like fantasy comedy, straight up science fiction, space western. At least one of them would be a Star Trek short. So I've got a number of pieces of short fiction in the pipeline for 2023.
Nice. I look forward to it. Like I said, you've been a favorite author of mine in the Trek universe, so I'm out to discover some of the other stuff that you've done as well. So, David Mack, thank you for talking with me here this afternoon. I appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And I warned you, didn't I?
And we're going to pick it up right from there, right from the fact that Tim warned me. We are back again chatting with film critic Tim Brennan. His film critic reviews can be found on aboutboulder.com. But he gets to talk to us today, and I get to verbally talk back to him about a very little. This is as little a movie as you could have while still calling it a movie.
And extremely little. Yeah.
All right, you set the scene for us. You tell us about this movie and why people should know about this movie, because you made me watch this movie.
I did. All right, so Kevin and I are going to be talking about the Canadian experimental horror movie Skinamarink. And Skinamarink, I should first of all mention, was made with a $15,000 budget.
Holy
God, doesn't look it. Now, the other part, this is the part in the podcast where you as the listener could reasonably expect to be told, what is the movie about?
Yeah, go ahead. Do that. Yeah, do that.
And that implies that the filmmaker of Skinamarink has told a complete beginning to end narrative, which they have not done.
I'm just holding my tongue now. You keep going.
Yeah. Now, here's what we do know about the film. It is set in what we think is a middle-class house. Strange noises. are emanating from parts of the house. The children's parents are barely interacting with them. At one point, a toilet disappears. At another point, the windows and doors disappear. The children trying to figure out what is going on and trying to deal with their mounting unease decamp downstairs in front of the TV, where in front of the TV, the only thing they have going on is to watch old Max Fleischer cartoons. Yeah,
old public domain cartoons.
Yeah, old public domain cartoons that have the very, very weird dream logic. At one point, a chair is upside down in the ceiling. You know, their mother is upstairs. She vanishes. Their father might be under the bed. A voice tells one of the children that he should put a knife in his eye. And, you know, if you're... Again, it's less a horror movie and it's more of just a mood piece. So if you're someone who goes into a horror movie and you're thinking, tell me why this horrible thing is happening, tell me what the protagonists need to do to either avoid or defeat the horrible thing, you ain't going to get it here.
No.
It's not going to happen, ever. But two things I think the film does really well. And the first one, let me just mention just a quick anecdote, and this is a thing that I mentioned in my review.
Before you do that, I just want to point out that the number of words that Tim has spoken, it far exceeds already the number of words in the movie. This is not a dialogue-driven movie by any stretch of the imagination. Now go ahead with your anecdote.
Well, I'm also overly verbose, so that's not surprising. Watching this movie, I was reminded of growing up, like as a very young child, in a house in Maryland. And my father was a lapsed Catholic, and my mother was an evangelical Christian. And she put on the wall at the top of the stairs a large portrait of Jesus. And it was creepy as hell. Like the joke I've had with my wife is that somebody sold my parents a portrait of Rasputin, and they just never knew the difference. Because this portrait of Jesus, he has very, very piercing eyes. And I can remember as a child, especially when the sun would go down and it would get darker, that the outline of Jesus would appear and the eyes were one of the last things to disappear. So when I would have to walk up the stairs to get to my room, I would do my very best not to look at those eyes. And when I would wake up in the middle of the night, you know, I might hear my parents snoring. I might hear a creak from somewhere in the house. And that kind of just, you know, relentless child logic, I knew that like the man who was in that portrait was climbing out of it and he was coming to get me. And I think Skinamarink does a really good job of putting the viewer into the headspace of a small child and hearing strange noises, seeing odd things that you can't properly explain, and just kind of reminding you, like, hey, remember when you were five and you heard that weird sighing coming from somewhere in the house? This is what that's like.
Yeah. Okay, how was I going to begin this? I was going to begin this with a good thing. And it sort of piggybacks off of what you just said, which is my best summary of the movie is that it's a film that is sort of occurring in the headspace of a child who is in that sort of semi-awake, semi-dream state. And that is what we are experiencing. And once we sort of accept that that is the quote-unquote reality of the film, then you can go ahead and sit through, dare I say, endure the film.
Yeah. Yep.
Now, I get the sort of, yeah, we can show, you know, close-ups of creepy Fisher-Price toys and, you know, make that sort of be inherently creepy to the viewers who remember the creepy Fisher-Price toys. and things like that. And that's sort of what I get it. I get where the filmmaker is sort of trying to play with that sort of sense of our emotions and make that into the scary film rather than the sort of ooga booga monster or whatever. And I appreciate that because I do prefer like a sort of suspense or a sort of a mind terror to a physical terror. I do appreciate that. What I don't appreciate is the complete lack of a story. The complete yep. lack of any sort of explanation as to why we are experiencing that, again, childlike dream state, half-awake state, or any sort of, you know, those looking for a resolution, I guess there could be a sequel, you know, but...
Oh, but there's no resolution.
No.
It literally just stops.
Yeah, yeah. And that's sort of it. And it's sort of, yeah, I had heard years ago, I'm a big fan of the old Mystery Science Theater 3000 series, and they always say that the worst of those that they had to endure personally was Manos, The Hands of Fate. And because they televised the MST3K version of that, it received so much more attention than it ever did originally that the original producers decided, well, clearly we need to make a sequel. I have not seen the sequel. I will not see the sequel because they didn't need to make a sequel.
Yeah, life is too short.
Yeah, yeah. But I do suspect that something will emerge from this particular horror film where they'll be like, oh, we can tell more of this story. You know, did you know there was a basement to the building? Or, you know something. And just, yeah, it's just going to...
I mean, I suppose you could do that. I just... You know, far be it from me to tell a filmmaker like what kind of art they should or shouldn't create. And sure. I mean, I do, and no sarcasm, I do believe this is a piece of art because it is creating an emotional response, not like, you know, disgust or annoyance, but it's
nausea.
It's
nausea
creating
is a reaction.
That there is that too, but it's creating a genuine emotional response. Now, and that's great. And plus, just the fact that they made a movie, that in and of itself is miraculous. Sure. Like, in its way, it is miraculous that Ernest Scared Stupid
sure.
was made.
Oh, sure.
I don't know that this is the first step on a sustainable career of filmmaking.
No.
And if this is his thing that he wants to make, you know, I would say, God bless him. I hope everything works out. And I would also say, I don't know that it's going to work out except for a very, very, very small amount of people. Like, he's not getting a phone call from Marvel Studios anytime soon.
Probably not. Yeah. Two more comments and then I will let it go. One comment is, there is a tradition in filmmaking, whether you're aware of this or not, because your name is Tim. My name is Kevin. There is a tradition in filmmaking of Kevin's not being the hero, of Kevin's being either the comic relief or the patsy or the sidekick or the, you know, whatever else. What do we have in this film? We have another Kevin. Is he the hero? No. So we're just going to dismiss that out of it. Just,
you know, I will remind you though, that the kid in Home Alone is named Kevin.
Yeah. And he's a prick.
But technically he is the hero. He may be a prick, it's true, but he is the hero.
I've been told that before. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to mention, just for the sake of adding my own sort of personal anecdote to this, is that this particular quarter at the middle school where I'm teaching, I offered as an elective Video Production 101. And I have 10 middle school students learning video production. Now, for those who don't know my sordid past, as I actually taught Video Production 101, basically, at a certain film school that shall remain nameless in the Los Angeles area. We'll leave it at that for legal
sure.
reasons. I have taken the same lesson plans that I taught to college students and am, in many cases, the same sort of PowerPoint presentations introducing the concepts, not changed them, and I'm now teaching them to 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. Now, this week, they produced one scene. They edited together their very first scene. And, you know, again, not telling a whole story, just a sort of a basic thing. I would give each of my 10 Video Production 101 students $15,000, and they would produce a movie better than what it is you had me endure. And they've produced one 30-second scene so far in their entire filmmaking careers, Tim.
So, see, there you go.
There you go.
And in all fairness, I don't know. Let me just actually check something real quick here. I don't know the director is Kyle Edward Ball. I don't know how old he is. Kyle Edward Ball could be in middle school.
Yeah, I was going to say he could be. So, that could be a nom de plume of one of my students. I don't know.
Exactly. I mean, if you have any shifty looking Canadian students, it could be him.
So let me ask you this in closing, Tim. Would you recommend, technically you did recommend to me to see this movie, but you recommend it to me because you figured I would be this angry and embittered about it and it would be entertaining to you. Would you recommend seriously that people watch this movie?
Well, it's a two-part answer. First of all, that is a bald-faced lie. I did not recommend it to you. And in point of fact, I recommended you not watch this because it would piss you off. And surprise, surprise, I was right. Secondly, would I recommend it? You know what? If you are someone looking for, you know, a genuinely challenging film experience, so if you're looking for something you've probably never seen before, yeah, definitely see this. But I mean, if you want to crash out on the couch with your best girl by your side on a Friday night and have a beer and a basket of wings, you don't want to watch Skinamarink with that. Watch it almost literally anything other than that.
Yeah, I can see the double feature now of Manos, The Hands of Fate with Skinamarink. That just, yeah, there's a way to kill a couple of hours. All right.
It's a way to kill a couple of people.
Tim Brennan, thank you as always, and thank you for filling in as our guest announcer. We will hear Craig's voice next time, I promise, listeners, but he's enjoying himself right now. So we will let him enjoy himself. And I enjoyed myself. Tim, did you enjoy yourself?
I absolutely enjoyed myself.
Excellent. Hopefully the listeners enjoyed themselves as well. In the meantime, you guys enjoy yourselves. Have a great day, and I don't know, keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars. Isn't that what Casey Kasem used to say?
Probably.
Have a good one, folks. And also, thank you for the good audio quality that you provided with your Zoom. You have nice audio levels there.
Yeah, I made sure my settings are all good. I've got a Blue Yeti Nano mic on this side, and
nice.
You know, I've got some nice, you know, sound insulation around it, and so I made sure that my output levels are good. And that's the other reason I don't broadcast video, and that's the reason I asked about it, is, you know, this way I'm able to plug the Yeti Nano right into my primary machine, which is a Mac Mini.
Nice.
And so it's, you know, if I were trying to send, you know, if I were trying to send video, then the audio and the video would be competing for bandwidth. This way I'm just sending maximum fidelity audio.
Yeah, I've had a couple of positive audio experiences lately because the last couple of people I interviewed were actually broadcasters and they had their home recording set up, so they just flipped that on and it was perfect. So I've been blessed with that, yeah. As opposed to the telephonic sounds of some of the Zoom interviews I've had to do already this year. But
yeah, like when somebody basically logs into Zoom through their phone.
Yes.
Yeah. Those are painful to listen to.
They're painful to edit too, because, you know, they'll cut in and out and the audio level rises and falls. So yeah, it's a ton of, so I appreciate you having the audio quality to do interviews.
Yeah, when I a number of years back when I realized I was going to be doing a lot more of this type of online promotion for my books, I decided it was a good business investment to invest in better audio equipment.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm kind of saying, if you can see around me, I mean, my studio, such as it is a work in progress, because I'm waiting for one of the bedrooms in our house to open up to become my home office and studio. So it's all a transition here. So.
Got it. All right. Well, thank you very much. I have about a million chores to get on with
me
to start my
well.
New year.
Yeah,
so.
I got to take down Christmas. So that's all part of the fun. So
yeah, I got to go grocery shopping.
All right. So. Well, you take care of yourself. Thanks again for chatting with me.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. Bye.